This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Inventions and the innovations they spur are the very heart of Qualcomm. It's the spirit of invention and how these inventions help people that inspires our employees, leads to innovative technologies, and continues to empower the worldwide mobile revolution. The technologies invented here are truly extraordinary, making it possible to connect 4 billion people with each other and with information instantaneously. And they have improved our lives in so many other ways. For example, our wireless reach team leverages Qualcomm's inventions to promote social and economic development globally and creates opportunities unheard of even a decade ago, lifting women out of poverty in Indonesia and connecting rural Chinese heart patients with doctors in Beijing. This work reminds us that even though Qualcomm has grown from its 7 founders to more than 31,000 employees, at our core still is the spirit of invention and service. It's our foundation, our heritage, and our future. After nearly 30 years since our founding, it's staggering to consider the growth of our industry and the billions of people our inventions and technologies have empowered. Mobile telecommunications, from 2G to 3G to 4G LTE and now beyond. To date, we've shipped more than 15 billion chips that power mobile devices based on these technologies. Our technologies allowed wireless networks to vastly expand their capacity and the number of worldwide mobile phone and smartphone users, creating a new technological, as Paul said, the largest technology and information platform in the history of the world that continues to empower people. It continues to empower organizations and businesses all around the world. Qualcomm technologies are empowering industries and creating new opportunities amid a flourishing age of mobile capitalism. But they also make possible new educational tools, new medical applications, more efficient social services, sustainability tools, cultural channels, and parenting aids. Our inventions have resulted in the ability of smartphones, tablets, and other mobile devices to operate in all global networks and become an indispensable part of everyday life for billions of people. And these inventions have resulted in tens of thousands of patents. Those of you who had an opportunity to look at our patent wall, you can see a small representation of those. And those patents allow us to share, collaborate, and transfer best practices and technology so that our partners can manufacture devices and build networks all over the world. Today's panelists will share their thoughts on not only the key issues we are all dealing with, but how and where they see innovation empowering people today and what's ahead. Moderating the discussion is Steve Clemens, Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic magazine. Steve writes frequently about politics and has his finger on the pulse of some of the biggest policy issues that impact our industry. Last week, Steve moderated an important discussion that Qualcomm sponsored with the National Journal on immigration reform, an issue we care deeply about here at Qualcomm, both as a member of the diverse and international San Diego community and also as a technology company that must compete for the best talent in the world. Steve is also editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live and National Journal Live, and publisher of the political blog The Washington Note. Steve is the founder of the American Strategy Program at the New American Foundation. He served as executive vice president of the Economic Strategy Institute and senior policy advisor on economic and international affairs to Senator Jeff Bingaman, and was the first executive director of the Nixon Center, now known as the Center for the National Interest. He writes frequently on matters of foreign policy, defense, and international economic policy, and his work has appeared in many of the major leading op-ed pages, journals, and magazines around the world. Steve also has professional roots here in Southern California. Prior to moving to Washington, he served for 7 years as executive director of the Japan American Society of Southern California, and co-founded the Japan Policy Research Institute with Chalmers Johnson, an organization dedicated to research and learning about Japan and the entire Pacific Rim. With that, please join me in welcoming Steve back to Qualcomm.
Thank you very much. Somehow you managed to find the longest resume I've ever had. I didn't quite know, but it's great to be back in San Diego. And I was hoping you were going to forget the part about the Japan-American Society, because I was going to use that as an opener here to say that I've been down to San Diego many, many times. It's so great to see old friends from those days in the mid-'80s. And at that time, Qualcomm was a corporate member of the Japan-American Society. I think our dues were $500 a year. And the word going around the time is that Irwin Jacobs, nice guy, brilliant, but this whole thing wasn't going to work out. It was a fascinating time. At that time in U.S.-Japan relations, Japan was very big at that time. We had the Maquiladora issues going on. You had a lot of investment. But many of the issues that we're going to be discussing today about how do you create a dynamic ecosystem that promotes innovation were as vital then as they are today, and perhaps are even more vital today. But we've got many more benchmarks to look at how to do that. But before I get into the substance and introducing you, our great panel, I want to thank Mary Walshock. I hope all of you know that the reason you're here at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning is we're all basically extras in a Mary Walshock movie production. we needed folks in the auditorium so their heads and stuff are nodding and whatnot. And you all received cards, hopefully, when you got your name tags. Did you get cards? Now, these cards are for you to write, you know, letters of, you know, I'm in the magazine business, so, you know, letters to the editor, complaints, and questions. And if we take your questions and you bring them up, they'll be picked up. You're welcome to stand up and lip sync and act while I read your question, because what we really care about is none of you. We care about the 10,000 people that are going to watch online. So I just want to make sure that was out of the way. Well, thank you. Let me say a few words about our fantastic panel this morning. We're going to get into a discussion. We're going to involve all of you in that discussion after a bit. But to my far right, we have Gregory Lucier. You guys really in this area hardly need an introduction, but again, it's not for the audience here. It's for the people online who are watching who don't have the foggiest idea who Gregory Lucier is. But he's a genius, formerly chairman and CEO of Life Technologies, a global life sciences company acquired by Thermo Fisher Scientific for $15.5 billion. $1 billion in 2014. He was less wealthy when I first met him and interviewed him, so I'm interested in how his attitude about life has changed. but he's been... He skis, he rides motorcycles, he's a fun guy, he's brilliant. But he built an enormous firm here in the San Diego region and has been one of the real leaders in the nation in biosciences in general. He's now chairman of the board of the Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute here locally. And he is, when we met before, we talked a lot about not only what it took to sort of create this realm of innovation in the biosciences area. He brought with him a chip that I carried around. I don't know how much that chip was worth, but it was the genetic sequencing, I thought of me. But $15.6 billion, yeah. And Gregory had been, I had seen something. I hang out a lot with spies. And in the spy crowd, but of course, when you hang out with American spies, you also hear from the Chinese spies, the Russian spies, eventually. And Greg is very high on their list of them wanting to make friends with him and to get acquainted with that chip that I was carrying around. It was a very heady thing. Then we have, in part, our host today, Paul Jacobs, is executive chairman of Qualcomm. He was CEO here from 2005 to March 2014. I've seen like 19 lines disappear from his face in this new role. He sort of seems to be, I ask him what he does for fun. He also skis. And then he said very authoritatively, I own the Kings. So that's fun. It's great to be with Paul Jacobs, who's one of the great innovators. And, you know, he's someone here. A discussion I had with Paul a while back, which was hilarious, had to do through his career when he was off in sales. And meeting folks in China and India and Korea and everywhere he may be, were the 8 or 9 different cell phones he had to simultaneously carry. And that was because he always had to pull out the cell phone of the client he was dealing with. And occasionally he would get calls on the wrong one. We'll get into that a little bit later, but you remember that story. That was a good story. And then we have Scott Peters, who, of course, you know as your congressman here in the 52nd Congressional District. It's a real pleasure for me to meet Scott, as I live in Washington. I assume he's occasionally in Washington, but it's nice to meet in San Diego, where he's out with constituents meeting people. He is a real leader. And when you go onto his website, you see right away how much this set of issues matters. I usually go in because if I'm interviewing a member of Congress, which I have the privilege of doing, I go do my own quick research, as we all do with, you know, Google and their websites to see what you're promoting. And very frequently, you'll see a member of Congress wanting to talk about something in which they've invested no time or effort. And I'm pleased to say that Scott Peters, when you first start out, the headline on your piece today is how you voted against a piece of legislation this past week that would have decreased science funding. And that was something that you put up right in the front. He is a member of the House Committee on Armed Services and on Science, Space, and Technology. You all know him from his leadership here in San Diego. He was listed by National Journal, my other publication, in 2013 as the fourth most independent Democrat in Congress. I'm going to go check that out. If I find out why you weren't first, maybe I can help.
Jim Matheson told me not to be first.
Never be first. And he's pragmatic. Today is his 28th wedding anniversary. It's great to be here with him. Wife wanted to kick him out in the morning and said, yes, go run off. He's a golfer. So we've got a great, great group of folks here. And I thought we would start off, and I hope you folks, we can turn this into a conversation and you guys can begin finishing each other's sentences. But I think when you get into the arena of innovation, what is required, I want to put it in a context of San Diego in 1986-87 when Irwin Jacobs and UC
and
San
Irving.
Diego. I'm sorry? Yeah, Irwin Jacobs were here, UC San Diego was here. You had people like Roger Revelle and others, but you didn't have the broad infrastructure. You didn't have an alley or a road like I just drove down. I don't know what road it was. I said, Qualcomm is there, and then no, Qualcomm's over here. That wasn't there when you were running into sort of the 19 buildings of Qualcomm before you got to headquarters. And I'd like you to kind of transplant yourself back then and ask, what did this region get right then? And what now today, when you come forward some 30 years, does the region need to get right again? Is this a current concern of continuing to create an innovation ecosystem? Or have you done it well enough that you can now rest on your laurels? I'm going to start with you, Paul.
I think, you know, back then, one of the things that really made first Linkabit and then Qualcomm was UCSD and sort of the education infrastructure here. And it was, you know, one of those things where maybe it was unintended consequences of the consulting policies, but Irwin started Linkabit because he was one of the world's experts on digital communications theory, and he used to get so much request, inbound request for consulting time that he finally decided to weave being a professor and do that full time. And then, you know, had great students, so that built the foundation of a great company, and then there was enough infrastructure around. It wasn't that there was nothing around. So, and certainly by the time Qualcomm started in 85, 86, then he had already been through the drill once before, and I think learned a lot of lessons from it. And one of the lessons that he learned, which was really critical, was about IP. And patent policy. And so at Linkabit, we had done work on the first TDMA systems. Now, I'm not going to get into the alphabet soup, but we had on the previous generation of technology, and all of the intellectual property went to another company. And so when we were working on CDMA, I remember being in meetings with cameras like this around that was recording everything so that we could have it for posterity and prove that. And so having the having that sensitivity to intellectual property and the fact that there was protection, that this little company with a handful of really important patents could go out and get these license agreements with the behemoths of the industry. And now you look at the change that's happened. I mean, now we're sort of the leader of the industry here, and a lot of the names that you know from those days are far diminished because they didn't focus on the innovation and so forth. And anyway, so having the education, having the patent policy, The other thing we always touch on is immigration. If I take that to the local level, what we did in San Diego was we always took the new people we wanted to recruit down for lunch on the beach. And as long as you could do that, and you kept them away from the real estate agent so they didn't realize how much the real estate cost, we would get them. And actually, the interesting thing is that still works today for San Diego, because some of the other places in the world...
Do you have like a Qualcomm picnic bench somewhere?
Well, there's a few favorite restaurants that we used to take people down to. But the price of real estate here is actually looks pretty attractive compared to some of the other places. Now, taxes, on the other hand, we have to worry about that a little bit, and sometimes we get people wanting to be based in some of our other offices around the world or around the country because California's tax rates are seen to be somewhat higher than other places. But you get the people here, and we've actually had quite a diverse population of employees here, and I think it is a very attractive place for people to come to still. It was then. As a funny aside, we're talking about the Sacramento Kings. The guy who's the majority owner of the Kings, Vivek Ranadive, he and I actually met in the World Economic Forum in Davos. We were sitting in a panel on dynamic resilience in a hyper-connected world, and neither of us knew what that meant.
You said, hey, let's talk about basketball?
That's exactly what happened. And he said he was putting together this bid, and I said, okay, well...
Was Steve Ballmer in the same meeting?
Ballmer wasn't there, but there's another story about that, too. So he told me he was putting together this bid, and were we interested? And we were interested, me and my brothers were interested. But then he went on to tell me that it was actually Linkabit that had brought him to the United States, that he was an immigrant from India, and not only had... Linkabit brought him, but my grandfather, who used to work in the storeroom there, took him under his wing. So, you talk about a small world and, karma and all those kinds of things. Just, it's sort of an amazing story about immigration and sort of the kinds of things, because he went on to found TIBCO and now, it's quite a successful company. So that immigration aspect of it's pretty critical. So
before I jump to Greg and you go back to the original founding of Qualcomm at UC San Diego, I don't remember the year, but one of the structural changes that was made in the innovation base, particularly with universities, was the passage of the Bayh-Dole Act. And the Bayh-Dole Act allowed essentially faculty and whatnot, universities' commitment to sort of the science and technology innovation space upticked hugely because they began to see a chance for a cut, and they probably put Mary Walshock on this, hiring the Bayh-Dole. I'm not sure, but did the Bayh-Dole Act influence your father's decision making on that at all, or were you pretty innovative? I see Greg nodding, so maybe it's not in your case, but was it the case in life sciences?
Well, it certainly has an enormous impact in the biosciences space, because if you get an NIH grant to these wonderful research institutes we have in San Diego, ultimately you can take that idea that was funded by the government and move it off to commercialization and get benefit from it. That was the essence of that act. And I think it was a brilliant act that we always have to make sure is protected and stays in place. Just a few thoughts about the environment here. I would build on Paul's point about San Diego in terms of its weather, its location is a great selling point. I came here back in 2003 from kind of buttoned up General Electric Company. I was living in Milwaukee, and I remember when I got brought out here to see this company that ultimately became Life Technologies, I was sitting in the lobby waiting for the next interview, and some guy walked in with his surfboard. It was lunchtime. He was wearing his wetsuit and was like, "Hey, dude." And I was like, "Wow, this is like so different than my world."
You have that or Jack Welch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Screaming at me all the time, right? And it was just an essence of this sunshine, hopefulness, entrepreneurial aspect of the community that I think was a real draw for me and has been a draw for so many others. What San Diego has that's pretty unique relative to other places in the United States or the world that I think has allowed it to be very successful in biosciences is the combination of three things. One, you do have these research institutes, UCSD, Sanford Burnham, Salk, Scripps, that provide a sustained level of employment in the region. And so you have thousands of scientists that create kind of the capability, the talent. The second is that you do have, because of the really marvelous ideas emanating out of there, it attracts capital. And so I wouldn't say it's been hard or easy. It's been relatively straightforward in San Diego to get funding for your new biosciences startup. If you have a good idea, you will probably get funded in San Diego.
And then Greg, even.
Yeah, right. You know, and the last is just this point about the ecosystem of the weather, is that, you know, the original one, HybridTech, spawned so many success stories personally. All those people stayed, and it just kind of was a self-generating cycle of success. You know, I'm the latest example of that. I'm not moving. I'm going to be here. I'm going to be part of the community, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So I think we have a flywheel effect, at least in biosciences, locally in San Diego right now.
Scott, you're out legislating around this. One of the interesting points of tension, and this is not about you, I think you're probably an exception, but when I spend time with real innovators, or I go to Silicon Valley, or up even now in Portland or Seattle, where you're beginning to see real investments in these communities, you meet people who are so cocky, and they feel like we're changing the world, we're sculpting the future, we're changing what mankind will look like, we're changing. We're creating carpets that if you walk across the rug, Intel is creating something where they'll be able to detect, well, someone's likely to have a stroke. There's all this stuff coming, you know. And this is why Paul's not going to have a stroke. He's feeling good right now. Executive Chairman's a good title, right?
No, I was just talking about Intel and Qualcomm.
But as a D.C. guy, I'm a D.C. guy, and you've got to go to D.C. occasionally. There's sometimes a resentment about regulators and a sense that D.C. is very antiquated, anachronistic, caught up in debates of the past, and doesn't recognize that, in fact...
Read this on my website?
This is actually, I'm just asking, you know, how you feel about it. I didn't read that on your website, but I did want to ask you if that's sort of how you feel about that tension and whether you feel like it's real. You work with 434 other people every week, and
that's what I always say. People ask me what's the biggest surprise about being in Washington, D.C., and it's not the weather or the plane flights or the time zones. That is a little bit of a surprise, but it's the culture. And what I think being here for 25 years, I started to take for granted was that everywhere people would just sit around a table and talk about good ideas and think about how to solve tomorrow's problems. But that is a pretty unique thing, and it's very San Diegan for us to do that for some of the reasons that Greg and Paul talked about. You know, what I find is that here, if you have a good idea, people like Paul and Greg are listening for them, and they don't care so much if you're a general or what member you work for or what your rank is or what your title is, which is a very D.C. thing. I think a lot of listening gets stopped because of the hierarchical nature of the place. And so there's a culture problem, but there's also kind of a problem of people's perception is they don't get what's going on here. And, you know, it's to be fair, it's hard to keep up with what's going on here. But the real opportunity in the economy is not the legacy industries that are so defended in Washington, D.C. It's the stuff that's going on out here that we need to be open to. So one of the things I talk about, you know, we're talking about wireless health or telehealth or whatever, the mobile health, whatever word you got for it. But there's tremendous opportunities for both better care, better access to care, better care, and for cost savings. But D.C. just doesn't get the idea that if you invest a dollar today, you might save $10 down the line. In my office, I have a slide rule. And I'm probably one of the youngest people here who still had to use a slide rule. But when I was in 11th grade chemistry, some kid came in with a $400 Texas Instruments calculator. And I'm, you know, my parents, my father's a minister. We didn't have money for a calculator. We hated that kid, right? But the point is, it wasn't very long before everyone had one. Now it's cheap. It's on your cell phone if you have a cell phone. It's on. You can get it at a little Casio thing at the drugstore for $10. That does all the same thing. It was innovation that solved the problem and did it cheaply over time. And that's something that D.C. just doesn't get. And so I've become a real jingoist for San Diego. I've become really mistrustful of the notion that if I don't understand something, I have to regulate it, which does seem to be kind of too much of a response. You know, I got to slow it down until I understand it, rather than sort of figuring out what can go on. So what you said is very true. It's a great frustration for me, but it's also something I'm very conscious trying to be an ambassador for innovation and science in San Diego is making sure that I'm aware of that when I'm in D.C.
So I did look up on your site, and you voted in a piece of legislation. The headline was, you know, Scott Peters decries bill designed to cut science funding or something of the sort. And I don't have the name of the bill in this because I didn't get the Qualcomm Wi-Fi password. I'm sure I could negotiate here in a minute because my link went dead. But in it, you had a name
LTE
of the bill.
LTE works here, though.
I'm sorry?
LTE works here.
Okay.
You use your cellular.
But in any case, the bill was named something to make it look as if it was advocating deeper support for science and research, and your argument was it wasn't doing that at all, that in fact it was cutting it. So you voted, you tried to amend the bill three times, all of your amendments were voted down, and then you basically said that this bill wasn't moving the interests of the country or science funding forward. And so I want to ask you a little bit about that one episode been doing, and I interviewed Bill Gates recently, and I asked Bill if D.C. and getting D.C. on the right track was a requirement for innovation continuing apace. That there was, and he was very clear. He says, we do not need D.C. D.C. can become increasingly irrelevant, and the pace of innovation. So I'd like you to kind of bridge that gap. Does Washington and the investments that it make matter or not? I just heard Greg talk about NIH funding, talk about NSF funding, talk about a lot of the funding coming out of this, and a lot of this is under attack right now. So do we matter? Or do they matter and can get on without us today?
Well, it depends on the perspective. I mean, I think, you know, it's probably true that innovation is going to happen around the world because it's going to happen. But the reason D.C. is important is that we'd like it to stay in America and in San Diego. We'd like to keep our advantage in science. And if we don't make the right decisions, we will squander our lead. And I've learned a lot of this stuff from these guys. But, you know, one thing you have to do is you have to invest in basic scientific research. Today, the smartest people my age, scientists my age, are in the United States. And sometimes they get picked off. But the problem is, and this is something I learned at the Salk Institute, is that, you know, it takes till you're 40 years old to get the lab where you can compete for the grant. In the good times, you would compete against the best scientists in the country. 25% were funded. Now it's 7% are funded. At the same time, you know, China's tripling its investment in basic research. So these kids were coming here saying, well, I'm not going to get my science done in the United States. I'm going to go someplace else or back to where I came from. So you overlay that with the immigration laws that don't let people who are educated here stay and start their companies, make their investments. The sort of lack of understanding for the promise of genomics or the promise of wireless health. It's just sort of as a cultural thing. And then you put these things in the way, like in medical device industry here is got an excise tax on it that's aimed right at it for, which is on sales, not on profits. And then the FDA approval for those devices is such that those devices are available, invented here 3 to 5 years earlier for patients in Europe than the United States. So yes, this stuff will happen, but I don't want the medical device industry to be in Europe. I don't want basic science research to be in China. And if what Mr. Gates is saying, that these things will go on, I can't disagree with it. I think he's probably right. But I think that the point of having a functional Congress is that we'd like to keep our lead, we'd like to keep the jobs here, we'd like to keep our economy going with the promise of this innovation.
You know, Steve, Bill Gates also spoke one time in Davos on something that I thought was very insightful. And he said, basically, we've had in the last 50 years this virtuous cycle of we had very robust basic innovation funding out of the NSF and NIH. The majority of that money went to universities, great universities. And he made a point that, you know, if you look back over the last 50 years, the top 50 universities are in the United States. And he projected it probably will stay that way for a while because they were getting those large grants of money for research that could then attract the best and the brightest in the world. And by the way, because of the population dynamics and the like, they typically stayed here. Well, they don't stay here any longer, right? Both because of the visa issues and because their home economies are more attractive now. And so we're breaking the virtuous cycle that has driven innovation in the world here in the United States. And that's why I think Bill Gates can be right about his other point. Innovation will continue unabated. But to Scott's point, why break the thing that has built this country and a very good standard of living for everybody? And that's why I think we're very short-sighted about not understanding the bigger picture.
How close are we to breaking that circle, really violating the covenants that hold that ecosystem together?
Well, Paul can talk to the visa piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to break like, a big explosion. It's going to happen over time, and all of a sudden you're going to realize, like what happened with manufacturing. Why are 95% of our revenues outside of the United States? Because all of the manufacturers are gone. They all went to China. And we're not doing much to bring them back. And you think about the geopolitical leverage of that. We're living through the implications of that. While you were asking that, I was thinking about something that one of Bill Gates' friends said, and it was Warren Buffett. And he said he likes to invest in companies that even an idiot can run because someday one will. And he went on to say he also likes to invest in the United States for the same reason. But the point that I'm making is that the United States has so many benefits that a lot of stupid stuff can happen and it will still carry on, but it's a question of the pace. And are we creating a great environment for innovation to happen? Are we sort of putting friction in it and putting sand in the gears? And it's right, that this issue of the world still comes here to be trained. Then they go back because we don't let them stay and build companies. And, the whole thing about the highly skilled immigration visas, H-1B, this is just a crazy thing that we're doing.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Before 9/11 in 2001, when you looked across programs across the United States, you looked in engineering programs. They were very robust and they were filled. You'd have some Americans and you had people from around the world, and there were issues. And you could saw very clearly when you went back to those H-1B debates then that there was a pressure to bring in more from the world. But it just all made sense when 9/11 happened. And after you began to look at the impact on people we let in this country and not, Bob Gates, who was then president of Texas A&M University, and I were asked to write a couple of articles together for the New York Times. And I had been worried that the visa rejection rates were skyrocketing. I'd been at a dinner with the president's science advisor, then President Bush's science advisor, John Marburger, the late John Marburger, and he said, we have a real national crisis brewing because we are cutting off the talent to get into the United States, and you will begin to see companies begin to chase that talent outside the United States. And I happened to see Christine Lagarde the next night, who was the France's science and technology advisor, and she was making some of the same points, saying we're going to benefit in France from your rejection of this talent around the world. The next night happened to see Craig Barrett, who was then the CEO of Intel, and said if we don't solve this problem in 6 months, we will chase the talent to where it goes, and they began moving R&D facilities and whatnot from Intel into China, into Shanghai. And the next day I happened to see John Ashcroft, who was then Attorney General of the United States, at a forum, and I asked Attorney General Ashcroft, I hear this from John Marburger, I hear this from Craig Barrett, and he says, it is a real problem, it's a crisis. It will take us 9 to 10 years to develop the technology and capacity to be able to separate good people from bad people at the border. And that was a fascinating indictment of Washington in a way. And I'm interested, so people don't remember to what degree we became very hostile to even engineering students and whatnot coming into the country. Today people act as if it's back to the general flow, but there may have been a generation lost. And I'm interested in just sort of taking stock. I live that, so I remember it palpably in my mind. What was going on? I wrote about those issues at the time, but what's the rate now? I mean, we don't have someone from the university up here, but from UCSD, but are things back to normal? Are things robust? Or have the patterns of, where talent flows in the world, did they adapt and you got sort of new rivers that went around the United States as opposed to through the United States? Paul?
It's not just the students, by the way. We have times when the CEO of a company that we're working with in China can't even get a visa to come to visit one of our developer conferences or come to a business meeting. I mean, and you go and talk to people and they say, look, if you don't want me here, then I'm not going to come. And why should I do business with you? And, you've seen some things happen along those lines already. So, yeah, it's not better. It's terrible. Not only are we sending the people back, but our tax policy also incents us to invest offshore, because we have this money that's offshore that says you can do anything with this money that you earned offshore except spend it in the United States on R&D and jobs and capital expenditures and these kinds of things. I mean, it's like this combination, this perfect storm of really stupid policy. That,
so let's just get the Paul Jacobs roster of stupid policies real quick. So it's the immigration for the visa for the Chinese businessman.
It's immigration policy in general. It's
tax policy.
The tax policy. I mean, the fact that we don't have territorial tax when everybody else does, it's just nuts. And people say, oh, well, you're going to move all your stuff offshore. We have 2/3 of our employees are in the United States, even though 95% of our revenues are generated offshore. Now, we have a particular situation where the licensing business generates what's called onshore revenue, even though the manufacturer is offshore. So we actually can pay our employees and, pay back our stockholders. But there are a lot of companies that don't have a business like that, and so they're even borrowing to support their employee base and their capital expenditures in the United States. And there's some tax benefits to them to do that, so maybe that's a mitigating factor. But in any case, the fact that you have this money that you can't spend here, we built a display manufacturing facility, brand new display technology that's powering these watches, and we built it in Taiwan. Because an advanced manufacturing facility is mostly about amortizing the cost of the factory, right? The cost of the glass and the chemicals that make up this display is fairly little. It's actually the machinery that makes it that's the expensive part. And if I have to pay extra for that machinery because I had to pay taxes off the top to bring the money back, then the piece of stuff that comes out the other side costs more, and it's just not competitive. So we had to build the factory outside the United States. The other thing that happened, going to the immigration issue, is that now all of the expertise is out of the United States. So you can't actually even build it here because there's not enough people who know how to run those kinds of factories in the United States anymore. So we've chased the talent, we've sent the money.
You had President Obama at your dad's house the other night. So did you raise any of this with him?
I was talking to him about patent policy primarily because it was a big, very hot issue. There was a bill coming up where, people have raised this issue that somehow everybody who invents now is a troll in some way. It's like they've used this.
Yeah,
word
you just
troll.
Lurk around like a submarine.
I'm inventing things just so that I can ambush somebody walking by the bridge. That's not our business model. We've created all of this technology. We spent $4 billion or $5 billion last year on innovation, and we provide it to everybody in the industry. But somehow that model and the model of participating in standards bodies is somehow been turned on its head, that's a bad thing. If you have an innovation that gets contributed to a standards body and available to the world, somehow that innovation should be very devalued. So this whole debate about patent reform was going on, and that's what I talked to him about. And one of the really interesting aspects of politics is that people seized on this notion where there are some bad players out there, and they try and get money from people by going to sort of the end user and suing a mom-and-pop store or something like that. This is not the vast majority of what goes on in the patent system, but it's sort of blown up to be a big issue. And so there was this part of the bill that was talking about protecting these end users, but it was written in a way that was so broad that it actually would have encompassed some of our customers who were very sophisticated companies, but they aren't necessarily the end, or they could claim that they could be covered by this end user. So we just wanted to make sure that the patent bill wasn't rushed through so quickly that these kinds of fixes couldn't get made. And fortunately, that actually has occurred so far. Now, we're not out of the woods because there are a lot of companies now that claim to be in the high-tech industry that really are what I'd call system integrators. They collect a lot of stuff from other people, they package it together, They don't necessarily even manufacture that product here. It's manufactured somewhere else. And then they say, okay, well, I'm high tech. But to those people, ideas and the cost of the creating the idea, that's an input cost to them, and it makes their product, in their mind, more expensive and their margins lower. So there are a number of companies out there who are trying to really devalue the value of intellectual property, and it will be a very big, very bad day for the United States, which is so much around innovation, if intellectual property gets devalued like that. And companies like Qualcomm will not be able to exist. And it's not Qualcomm as it is today, a big company that can do a lot of stuff ourselves. It's Qualcomm as it was when we started, which was a tiny company with a handful of really, really important ideas and patents, and who was able to stand up to the big players who needed to integrate our technology. And if they could have come to us and said, I'm going to be able to take that for free because you have to participate in the standards body, and now a standards essential patent is not valued, Qualcomm would have shriveled up and died. And we wouldn't have had the next generation, you know, and all of these generations of technology that we've been able to create. Now, some of those big players would have liked to see Qualcomm shrivel up and die, as you mentioned earlier. So you can imagine the incentives in the industry. You know, there are not.
I think it was just more of a betting pool at that time.
Yeah. But the bet paid off.
Before I jump to Scott, Greg, I'd asked this question really, really bouncing off something you said about creating the healthy ecosystem. And you know, I asked Paul, and he says, well, that's something that'll go over time. But what I just heard Paul lay out was a lot of frustration with the...
Do I seem frustrated?
A lot of the decisions that this country made. You know, when in the policy world or in these issues, there are choices. And what I'm always an advocate of is accountability for choices that were made years ago. It's important to shine a spotlight on important policy choices that were made with manufacturing or with regard to the repatriation debate or what's going on with the immigration arena today or what's going on with China and how to get, you know, a reasonable arrangement with China that both, you know, sees China grow but not where they're ripping you off every chance they can. So I want to come back to you since you started, you know, this channel of thought. Are you, when it comes to the immigration questions, the sort of flow of talent, do you see that flow of talent able to come back in a way? I mean, that was the story of America, right? The story of America was the brain drain problem for the rest of the world. We would bring in the best and brightest in the rest of the world. They would root here. And to the degree they went back, they would spread the DNA of the United States. So,
I think that, Steve, the problem isn't the students coming to the United States because they get the entry visas they need. The issue is they're not staying here any longer once they get the degree. And it's because, again, their home economies are very vibrant and a good place to be now, and because we haven't allotted enough space for them in our visa system to stay. Look, the second issue, just to put on the table, just to build on Paul's point, is the tax system in the United States. Again, the system we had still living with today was fine 25 years ago. We're now in a global economy. U.S. companies are making tons of money overseas, and they have no incentive to bring that money back to the United States to invest. I think the media has it completely wrong when they talk about these inversions. This is a good thing to do if you're a corporation, and it really is just a symptom that the Congress isn't getting this fixed and should get it fixed fast. The U.S. economy would probably tick up 2 or 3 points if we did it, and trust me, U.S. companies would bring the money back and they would invest here. It's so freaking simple. It's unbelievable. And you should ask him why it's not happening.
It's simple. I'll tell you. Here's the thing. And this is a, you know, and I'm not going to tell you anything startling, but the, you know, my first term, my one term in Congress has been all about these elections coming up from the beginning. And what happened is Dave Camp, who is the...
So you were elected, and so your biggest concern is what's coming up in 2014?
No, I wanted, people here know that I like to actually get things done, but the, you know, the first things that we were sent to vote on were all set up to be, not to be legislation, because the Republicans never talked to the Democrats about whether they'd agree to it, but to be the basis of a 30-second commercial.
So posturing.
Yeah, posturing. That's all what it's been. They call them message bills. And I thought, you know, that we should be beyond that after the re-election of the president. But that's what it's been about.
I don't know, 167 votes against Obamacare.
Yeah, so one of the things that happened was Dave Camp, who's a Republican from Michigan, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, great guy, used to come to the New Dems, our sort of pro-growth caucus. and talk to us about reforming the tax code along the lines of what Greg would say. Two things, two parts of it are lower rates that are more competitive with the rest of the world. I mean, we're, our rates are nominally very high with a bunch of loopholes and deductions that are sort of distributed almost randomly across the economy. But to make that more competitive and also to allow for the repatriation of foreign money and for a territorial tax system that's comparable to other countries so that when you make money overseas, you can bring it back. And also that he was very honest about what it was. So that, you know, obviously if you lower someone's rates but you take away their loopholes, the tax rate actually may go up. But he was very honest about what it would cost and what the changes would be. He worked on it for his whole career. This was to be his crowning achievement. And all the tax discussion, by the way, while we were in Congress was, well, don't talk about those extenders. Don't talk about this incentive. It's all going to be taken care of in comprehensive tax reform. Well, the day after Dave Camp announced his plan, which was with a lot of input, the speaker said, no, this is dead. It's dead. And the next week, Dave Camp announced he wasn't running for re-election. So this is where, frankly, you all come in, is that I think that it would be tremendously helpful if people were paying attention to this kind of dynamic. And it's great to talk about what we need to do. We're in violent agreement. These are two of my professors, you know. So I tell Paul Jacobs' repatriation story about the plan in Taiwan. I tell that once a week, Paul. But the point is, how are you going to get it to move? And we have to deal with the tremendous partisanship.
Let me ask you about that, because I know, on the Democratic side, I've sat down with Congressman Delaney, John Delaney from Maryland, who was, I guess, the only former CEO in Congress, who's got a lot of great ideas on repatriation. And just last week, as was mentioned, there was a Qualcomm forum in D.C. I had Haley Barbour. You guys know who Haley Barbour is? Yeah. Haley Barbour should have his own reality sitcom show. I mean, it would be interesting. He was former governor of Mississippi. But, I mean, to kind of look at good old boy kind of pork barrel politics, I can think of no one better than Haley Barbour that captures that. And I had him on stage with Luis Gutierrez, the congressman from Illinois who's been pounding away on immigration. These two guys agreed. The bigger than that, which Qualcomm was not involved in, I had Grover Norquist. You guys know who Grover Norquist is? Considered the most feared or most hated or most powerful man in Washington, but I got Grover on stage with Rahm Emanuel, who many Republicans feel the same way about Rahm as the Dems feel about Grover. The two of them agreed entirely on immigration reform. And people said, how did you do that? And I said, because there are people in both. These are powerful people. These are not trivial personalities on the edges of power. Power pulsates through these communities. So that's where I hear the issue of partisanship. That's where I'm going, what?
But here's the problem.
Here's the next question, Steve.
Is, after that meeting where they agree on everything, they will go out and they will snipe the person from the other party who made a compromise. And so there's a little bit of intellectual incompletion.
But Grover's group, Americans for Tax Reform, and Haley Barbour, they did this poll that's showing that conservative Republicans and even Tea Party identifying Republicans support immigration reform. So I want you to give us advice in a kind of counseling way that if so many grassroots Republicans and many may believe in immigration reform and members of Congress running in 2014 see that, what's the structural block in their leadership? Boehner has said what you did. I want to get things done, and I don't.
Mr. Boehner has the power to put anything on the floor he wants. If he put H.R. 15, which is the immigration bill, on the floor, it would pass overwhelmingly. So when he says he wants to get things done, I always say, great, you're the speaker. This is going to be exciting. Let's go. And then it doesn't come. And he killed this tax reform policy, which he touts, and they shut down the government. So what the dynamics of elections,
so
and I'm concentrating
caucus,
on this week.
Is the Tea Party caucus that strong?
You know, look, I try not to be the most partisan Democrat.
You don't have to be partisan, just an objective.
But you asked about the Tea Party, and if they all vote like the Tea Party, you know, I can't tell them apart. If they say there's only 30 Tea Party people, but all 230 vote that way, I can't tell the difference. I'm not that nuanced. If you say you want to get things done, all you have to do is put the House version of the immigration bill on the floor. You can put the Senate version on, which is much, you know, spends way too much money on a fence. The House bill essentially provides performance standards for security, that a little bit more flexibility, because there's just some places along the border you can't put a fence. But either one, if you put either one on the floor, they'd both be bipartisan, they'd pass bipartisan. So what I think is what I think I would say to voters is that you have to go help the people who make the agreements. Every agreement will have in it something that someone else doesn't like. And I see
what do you mean, the people who make the agreements? What
the
do you
people
mean?
Who in Congress who are willing to sit down. Because it used to be, look, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, and that was the courageous guy, the guy who went off and railed against Congress, right? Well, now everybody's Mr. Smith. And the courage is the willingness to go to the middle of the room, shake hands with somebody, and give something up that your base is going to be mad about. You have to be the reward in that. And I think these guys would be the reward in it. Someone has to go out there and say, you know what? It wasn't perfect, but thank God we got a tax reform. We spent way too much money on the fence, but thank God we got immigration reform. That's going to help our technology companies, help us, you know, pick our crops, help home health care. I didn't think it was perfect. That's not what I wanted. But, you know, the next day they won't be mad. They'll say, okay, we did it. And there has to be a reward for that in politics. Because as long as the partisanship, you know, we say Congress is partisan, but you all are pretty partisan too. You join these extremist groups, and you pat yourself on the back. But in my side, I mean, you should see the emails I get from Move On about what a traitor to the country I am every time I do something. And that gins up a lot of concern from people. I know that happens on the right wing too. There's a real fear that's created by that. You don't see the reward in coming to the middle to make a deal. What we need from people who care about this stuff is to create a constituency for the middle, create a permission and even an affirmation that making an agreement is the right thing to do, even if it's not.
See, I have a theory that Qualcomm is to blame for all of this, in that the connectivity that has been achieved in getting everybody linked has created this weird dynamic, and I don't mean this, I mean this facetiously, but there's an element of truth to the, to
good,
the connectivity
I was
issue.
Forward, right. Like
yeah,
I was ready to
yeah, 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 I was worried. But that the
I got a whole bunch of friends here.
In
too.
American politics, it's very easy to create a spike of action from people who are connected. It doesn't matter if that spike is in Tahrir Square in Egypt, or whether that spike is on net neutrality issues, or whether that spike is on corporate tax issues. I had Randall Stephenson, the CEO of AT&T, and he was one of the most strongest advocates of corporate tax reform, making many of the same arguments that Paul just did. And I saw him one day, and he said, you know, I saw Eric Cantor and John Boehner this morning. They all agree with me. I went to the White House, met President Obama. He agrees with me. I even met Valerie Jarrett, who's the most powerful woman behind the president. She agrees with me. And yet he couldn't move forward. And I said, your company's based in Dallas, Texas. You're one of the biggest employers in Texas. A lot of the Tea Party types are from Texas. You're employing them. Where are you failing to communicate the interests of your people? I said, you know, to get these other people, why isn't that happening? And he says, well, that's a long story. So, you know, it is an interesting question to sort of look at the broader subject of if the welfare of a country, you know, when you look at what's happening in the middle class today and how important it is to have, I mean, that's what this is really about. Innovation and embedding innovation in a country is really about changing the dynamics and investing more deeply in the prosperity of a growing middle class. Do I have that right, Paul?
Sounds good to me. Look, if you think where the middle class, a lot of middle class wealth came from in the manufacturing sector.
Right.
That's not here anymore. And people talk about bringing it back, but you know, it's a high an advanced manufacturing plant, like I said, it's not about a lot of labor content. It is about it's the facility itself costs most of the money that then turns into the cost of the product. And so I do think that there is a play for, you know, North America in some of these lower skilled things to try and bring up the, you know, the base. But my guess is it's probably Mexico that's might be more suited to benefit from that, because the labor rates are a little bit lower. They're now competitive, you know, getting more competitive with China. Obviously, energy costs are lower. Shipping costs to North America are lower. I mean, you could imagine that could get recreated
near the United States, but maybe not directly in the United States. So that, what does that mean for the United States? It means that it's creating the ideas, the innovation, and you know, you look at the kind of wages that we're able to pay to employees here. I mean, they're quite high because we can generate good margins from, and you know, continuing to innovate. If we stop innovating, by the way, we'll get commoditized, and that will go away. So it is, you know, hypercritical for us to continue to drive that technology treadmill, and then that is going to create all this other wealth. And if you look at San Diego, the success of Qualcomm created a tremendous amount of economic activity in San Diego, and the employees that we have, half our employees are still in San Diego. So that creates good wealth for the middle class.
Thoughts, Scott? I think I just saw the president release this week, I don't know what they're called, manufacturing support centers, 12 or 13 locations. Southern California is one of the sites, but places like Cincinnati, Ohio, and others. And in that, again, when I was thinking of today's topic, which is really the ecosystem for innovation, I had the privilege of meeting Dwayne Roth, whom some of today was dedicated to through Mary Walshock, before he passed away, and it kind of occurred to me, he was a fun guy, that, you know, I was reading about his funeral online this morning, that everybody at that funeral was kind of like the parts of the ecosystem that matters for innovation, and it made me think about what can one be, you know, thinking about in terms of the replicability of that, right? With all the people that are going to be watching this online, you know, recently I was with Siemens in Worcester, Massachusetts, and they also sponsored a forum in Norwood, Ohio, which is inside Cincinnati, and looking at the community colleges, the universities, the manufacturing extension centers, venture capital folks, and looking at basically, you know, the quality, the feedstock, if you will, of young people and whatnot, and how to kind of get them into STEM, how to move that along. So I'd love to get your thoughts. We've talked a bit about immigration, but can we talk a little bit about, you know, picking ourselves up by our own bootstraps and where that fits in terms of an innovation ecosystem? Greg?
I was at my daughter's high school graduation last night, and so I had to sit through there, and they announced the majors and the colleges where they'll be going. And this is our last child to go off to college, with two previous ones. And our two previous kids, just in full disclosure, are engineers and just finishing up college. And I was...
Did you try and keep them away from that, or did you
No, I was, like, you know, driving them into that, you know, like a drill sergeant. They hate me for it, but...
They'll love you now.
I know, they will love me now that they're through the other side of it. But I was surprised, though, still, how few people are going into the tougher majors at the university level. Most of the majors that were announced were business. And, you know, again, nothing against a business major, but, you know, if we're going to be an innovation-based economy, you ultimately have to know something, and you got to be good at math or biology or engineering. And I think a colleague of ours, Craig Mundy, the former chief technology officer at Microsoft, said it best. He said, you know, if you go to a big public university and you're killing yourself doing, pick your engineering major, electrical engineering, and everyone else is doing business, and they're out on a Wednesday night having fun, and you're never out, that's a tough proposition. And so you just have this social dynamic where it's an easier path to go towards these other majors, it's tougher to get these technical degrees, and the social pressures at the university level are just very difficult, that it's hard to stay with the major. So the other factoid is, not only are people not choosing the STEM majors at the university level, but if you look at the dropout rate from those majors into business or pick your other major, it's profound. So, you know, that's the dynamic going on today, and I don't have a solution to it, but I do know that if we're going to be innovation-based, you got to know something.
We're actually working on something right now. I setting up an institute at UC Berkeley around this issue exactly, of how to motivate kids to enter into STEM and stay in STEM. And the key thing that we're going to do is focus on design. And the fact that you now have these new technologies, 3D printing technology, and all sorts of things, so that you can rapidly prototype and iterate hardware like you used to be able to do, or I mean, you still do, but like people thought about software, that I could iterate it and I could do experiments and change it and make it great over time. Well, you can do that with hardware now. And so the idea is that the kids, we're going to flip the classrooms, kids will watch the lectures online, and they'll actually have experiential learning in the design studios. But the cool part of that is that they will build things in those studios that look like commercial products. And they will be able to, my dream is that they'll go back to the dorm with this cool thing, and their buddies will all go, well, how'd you do that? You know, that's magic. Well, I know how to do that, and you don't, because you didn't learn the hard things. And of course, you know, you get all sorts of fun things. I mean, one of the guys I was talking to about this said he had a design class, and they had white LEDs that just come out. And he said, okay, because he was already running a class like this. And he said, okay, well, the design project for this year, for this semester is take the white LED and build something with it. And then they had a contest about, you know, the different ideas and so forth. Well, being a university, the winning idea was a shot glass that had the white LED in the bottom, and when you smacked it, it started to flash and stuff like that. And then he actually went to China and got these built, so they actually handed them out as prizes. So it was a little bit of a combination of the
two. Now, how old was this person?
The person who was telling me about it, or the person who did the design?
Designing?
It was a college student. It was an undergraduate.
And is it possible, I mean, just in this, because, you know, in our Innovations Forum, which the Atlantic have been hosting, we've been bringing in people who are, you know, innovators in the 3D printing space, and you sort of see these young people come in, and we've seen the same experience. Or you've got what Siemens has done is giving a lot of the software away to sort of show what they've been doing. A lot of the Siemens software was, you know, designed to get the Mars rover on Mars, you know, to kick this thing in. So they're giving these young people this opportunity to get in and play and kind of get into the mix of design and software capacity that can do all of this. How do you get scale in the kind of thing you're doing at Berkeley?
Okay, so what will happen is it will start out, there's, you know, it will start as a small thing. It actually has been distributed right now. There are maker spaces around the campus, but they're not coordinated.
I've been trying to get a maker space in Congress. Wouldn't that be cool? That'd be a cool Scott Peters initiative.
I could do that by
it?
Myself. Yeah.
Yeah, what's that?
I could do that by myself.
You could do that by yourself. Just get one of these things. Maybe it could be a Qualcomm-supported makerspace that you chair the makerspace caucus.
So anyway, so we're building a building now that will have a bunch of these spaces in it that will now, you know, we've already thought, okay, how many students can we get through and how many classes? And then the goal is to actually try and change the whole engineering education to have a more experiential thing. Okay, then the question is, how do you scale that? So we've been talking about, you know, do you do things like, obviously there's an online component to it, but then do you affiliate with other area, you know, other places that can set up these kinds of facilities? And I think, you know, it's a whole issue of where education is going to go. Are there going to be, you know, a few superstar professors that do all the lectures, and then everybody else is going to be about sort of coaching as opposed to standing on a stage and giving the lecture? And so there's, you know, that's a whole other topic we could get into for a long period of time. But I think that there is some degree of scaling and there's some degree of not. And it's why I think that these elite universities, these research universities, that everybody's worried that the internet is going to, you know, sort of diminish them. I don't think that's true. I think that there is a huge benefit to providing an elite education to an elite group of people and spending the extra effort to make sure that those people are going to be the leaders and the innovators. And the United States does that well. And we know very much that bringing people together into a space where they can run into each other and you create opportunities for serendipity to occur, it's a very important thing. And, you know, it was a big trend to say that the world is flat and you don't need to be near anybody else to do. And it's not true. It doesn't really work that way.
I'll let Tom Friedman know. Scott?
Just starting a little bit earlier, because I think that I certainly agree with...
You found something cool on your cell phone, right?
I did. I'm going to refer to my cell phone. It's a really cool device. You should all get one. So we're talking a little bit about accessibility to education. The cost of a public education has gone up 300% in the last 30 years in real terms. And so public education is where 80% of kids get educated. So we have to give some attention to that. One of the things we're working on is I could only have gotten my education with financial aid. We want to make sure that that's affordable. And so some of us have a bill to allow refinancing of public student loans to 4%. The government gets its money for 3.5%. Why we're charging 8 or 9%?
That might be targeted towards STEM fields, but in any event, that seems like a prudent thing to do. Before that, we're talking about the Common Core. The federal government doesn't do a lot with state and local. State and local governments tend to have control over what's taught in K to 12. But one thing we're trying to promote is a Common Core, so the sense that agreement among the states, it's not even a federal issue, about what would be taught. And one of the things that I'm trying to push is computer science. Why? I dissected a frog in high school. That was pretty cool, but maybe that's still something they do today. But probably people should be learning how to code. And I have a friend, Derek Kilmer, who represents Washington States, and I sent him this because I thought this might come up. He's got stats on the AP computer science test. 30,000 people took it last year, the AP computer science test. In 11 states, not a single African-American student. In 7 states, not a single Latino student. And only 20% of the ones who took it were women. So we need to do a better job of, before we get into Berkeley, to make sure that we're getting more people interested in this stuff at the beginning level.
By the way, Berkeley is fairly diverse. I mean, Berkeley does a pretty good job.
Yeah, I was only picking it because you referenced it. But before we get to Texas A&M.
Bob Gates is gone. So pick on Texas A&M.
We need to get kids interested in it. And finally, I think the other thing you have to give some consideration to is early childhood education, which is a tremendously cost-effective way just to get kids to succeed in school and perform anyway. President Obama has advocated it, but the state that's done this is Oklahoma. So when you have Oklahoma and Obama in agreement, you got something going on. And
I think I was going to say that we are going to reach out to the high school student, because I actually do believe that you need to learn this stuff before you get to college, and that those statistics you just said are frightening.
So one of the debate, one of your comrades in Congress, Aaron Schock, a Republican from Illinois, has been working as well, not only on the STEM issues, but he kind of considers how to have the STEAM caucus to sort of add arts, culture. Yo-Yo Ma has been a big national advocate of this. And so when I look at these questions and I ask, okay, they need to know something, Greg, I get that. I'm going to go deep here. You gave us a lot of time. One of the really interesting, The Atlantic has just announced a partnership with the College Board. And the College Board, which administers the SAT test, a lot of the AP scores, et cetera, one of the really interesting is how do you instill in students an interest in critical thinking, critical analysis, critical writing, so that it doesn't matter whether that's an engineering interest or it's engaging a piece of art or engaging in whatever. How do they basically come into contact with something, analyze the context of that, and learn to write and argue and create an argument? Because when you go through and you talk to the head of the College Board about what they see in essays and writing as something, is a huge shift away from critical thinking and critical analysis to sort of a self-analysis, that a lot of the questions are designed so that everything that one writes about becomes self-referential about one's own evolution, which is a way not to know something or not to engage something. It's a very subtle distinction. So I'm going to invite all of you into a process where we're going to be working with the College Board to create a national contest for the best writing in high schools across the country. We're going to be dealing with 120,000 AP teachers across the country and sort of instilling techniques, tools, thoughts, materials, and whatnot to do this. And what we're interested in eventually, we're going to run a poll through the Atlantic, is to basically look at what all of you think are those things that young people might encounter or think about. It could be anything that you find to be something stimulating, so that we can basically create material that we think popularly is nonetheless interesting, but young people not having that encounter, that we're slipping away. And that's why when you look at why are people going into finance as opposed to other things, there may be something there that our educational system has not learned how to preference critical thinking and critical analysis, which is a very important part of innovation. I mean, it was, when you again think about, we're taking this subject of innovation down to its very deep roots. But when you look at that, you look at other, elements of somebody has an idea, how do they create the context for that idea, how do they work through problems? And we haven't talked about failure yet, and I do think that is an interesting component. I did have Mark Andreessen, who many of you know is a big tech investor, and I had him at an Atlantic event last week, and he says, I don't have much patience for the failure discussion. I hate failure. I don't like investing in failures. I don't want to be near failure. But I mean, but
didn't
part of it is when you're. I'm sorry.
Then he started Netscape.
Yeah, he did. I think he was one of. I mean, you guys know better. So, good point. I'll show him this clip. But in any case, I'm interested in how you guys think about that. That when I hear Paul talking about what you're instilling in UC Berkeley, I think it's so important to give people the tools, the context to begin interacting with things and get them that desire. But I think this critical analysis, critical thinking, and engaging stuff has got to be part of it.
But I mean, that's a key. You know, the design methodology is one of critical analysis of what are the needs and also what solutions have been created. And how do I then improve that and iterate again and see how people react to it and then iterate again or see how that solves the problem and so forth. So that's a key component. But I would, going to what you were saying about art, I mean, that's also a piece. We're actually going to have students from California College of the Arts come and work with the engineers that are in the engineering school at Berkeley and do projects together. And the reason why I feel it's so important is that if you look at the value of Apple, I mean, Apple's value comes from having created a product that other people had already built smartphones, myself included, and yet they built a beautiful one. And art was a key attribute of it. And that's what created the tipping point that mainstream people said, aha, I now need this. Instead of complaining about having more features in because they just made phone calls, said, oh, okay. Give me the next thing. And it was art was a critical
piece. Has art
and
design become more important to Qualcomm?
It is. I mean, I was telling you the story that when I first started, the people that were working on the user interfaces, they were somehow not like the really, tough, macho, whatever, really great engineers somehow because that was so soft, Now when we're building our chips, a lot of the graphics processors that go in there, it's not because of 3D games. It's because that user interface that you want to move really fast when you touch it and it is having 3D effects in it and all sorts of stuff, that's actually what's stressing the processor a lot, that user interface. So it went from being this soft thing on the side to almost a critical component of what we're investing in. And in fact, the ideas behind this was about how it is that humans interact with the device and make this an easier thing.
I really need to get one of those.
But I would say, too, that this is a San Diego thing. And Paul may correct me, but I've always been struck that this very space we're sitting in is a music performance space. So, Qualcomm took the expense to build something for music, and they saw that, literally, that arts is central to the effort in a kind of a literal way. There's another guy named Jerry Edelman who just passed away, who was one of our Nobel Prize winners, who was the leader of the Neurosciences Institute. He had the same thing, had a big music performance space. And these guys, they're way smarter than I am, but they certainly understood the connection between the arts and that kind of creativity that supports or draws and what they're trying to accomplish. And so I think it's a very San Diego thing. I think that the Qualcomm had a large part in establishing it.
Greg, let me ask you. You've now wrapped up one big company, and now you're running in the nonprofit space, advanced research. And this is less about you per se, but as you, I think the challenge of anybody that moderates a lot of these kinds of forums, particularly about technology and innovation, public policy choices, is I often worry that we're sometimes talking about anachronistic issues and don't know it, that we're talking about the way things were. Because when you look at where we're going, if you go and spend any time at companies like yours or Qualcomm or Cisco or any Intel or this Box, you see a very different world racing towards us that 5 years from now, we're all going to be in a really different kind of space and operating differently. And I'm interested in, how, one, from a San Diego region, an innovation region, what do you think the next big bets are that you would make if you had unlimited resources and another 200 years in your life? What would you think would be the next cool thing? And then also, what are the questions that we're not asking that we should be asking when it comes into this innovation space?
Well, if I had 200 years to live, then I would bet on the
big... there are people in Silicon Valley that are right. Talking about the end of death.
Well, actually, that's one of them, right?
Right?
So I think a trend for the 21st century is moving science to engineering of this thing we call the human system. And so that's a trend that will play out over the next 100 years, and our grandchildren's grandchildren will have a completely different existence than we have. Perhaps they have a longer lifespan, but they will certainly have a lifespan that has a lot less disease in it. So, you know, all of the ideas that play towards that are going to be moneymakers, assuming the technology is right and the timing is right. So that's one megatrend. I think the other big megatrend is the one that Paul's company is, on an inevitable path, which is changing the nature of information and its interaction with human beings. To me, that's a trend over the next 100 years as well that utterly transforms the human existence in a different way. And, the beautiful thing about San Diego is those two megatrends are resident right here. And so we're doing things right. If we can do a few more things right, San Diego has a very bright future for decades to come. So that's what I think about. That's where I'm certainly putting my own money to work. And, the key in all of that is the right people, the right timing, the right technology. And if you can bring those three forces together, you should have a lot of fun.
San Diego is in such a wonderful place for this whole notion of mobile health because we have such a strong life sciences sector and we have such a strong telecom sector. And you see all these little companies working on new sensors, and some of them are things that you'll wear on your body. Some of them even, we're doing clinical trials right now, or we're supporting a clinical trial right now that's being done in San Diego for a little device smaller than a grain of sand that will go in your body and tell you 2 weeks ahead of time when you're going to have a heart attack. So you get that phone call telling you to go to the doctor. That's actually a good phone call to get because your heart hasn't, had any trauma yet to it if you can catch it that early. So those kinds of things I think are really fascinating. San Diego should be the epicenter of mobile health. Now we know that healthcare moves slowly. It's another policy issue that's interesting that many of these things in mobile health may not actually start in the United States, that it will happen in emerging markets where there's a lower regulatory burden and so forth, and then boomerang back into the United States unless we figure out better ways to manage this. And there has been some progress, so don't let me leave you with the thought that it's nothing's happened in that respect. But it is still quite difficult to get things through the whole regulatory process. But that, as Greg said, this whole notion of the knowing data about people, being able to personalize medicine, a lot of work that's going on here in San Diego around there. Greg was doing a lot of it. That is going to be a massive, massive trend. And it's going to reduce costs, it's going to increase productivity, it's going to not just increase lifespan, but it's going to increase health span. So the part of your life where it's really good is going to be longer and longer. And I think San Diego is going to be a big winner. If I was really going to live 200 years, there are some dark things that I do worry about that I think that, humanity, there are existential threats still. And I think, bioterrorism to me is, the fact that there's a company up in San Francisco, pretty young kid, has figured out how to print DNA. And so you can send him the sequence of DNA that you want, and he will send you a vial of it back. And it scares the heck out of me. And that kind of stuff, you just need to worry about those kinds of things because we can kill ourselves.
Our scariest article in the last few years that, in my view, in The Atlantic, I don't know how many of you were avid readers of The Atlantic, it was called Hacking the President. It was written by a guy named Mark Goodman. And in this piece, it tells the story, which was of the increases in science of a place like Greg Lucier's former company. You can potentially, over time, tailor a pathogen or something to go after a single person. And so what we learned in WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks was describing what was going on, is our Secret Service goes to great lengths to keep President Obama's glasses, towels, anything he may have used, from falling into the hands of foreign governments when he travels. And at the same time, we acquire those things of foreign leaders when they come here, which is an incredible thing. It's in The Atlantic called Hacking the President. It's the scariest article you can imagine if you want to begin looking at this kind of bioterror question at that level. And it's a real leap ahead, but what Mark Goodman is saying is that's with us today.
You could imagine a bad actor creating a vaccine and a virus, vaccinating their people, killing everybody else. And it scales. I mean, we know that disease scales. The way that this interconnected nature of society
you know, things move fairly rapidly. So I was at the XPRIZE last visioneering thing where they come up with the new XPRIZE last year, and there was a request from Homeland Security to do an XPRIZE round. How can you rapidly create a vaccine? You detect a pathogen, and you, how do you get a vaccine quickly made? It didn't win. What won actually was an Alzheimer's XPRIZE, which also affects us. But it's a huge, huge issue.
And that, so Scott, you're going to fix this stuff, about. Right? We need a good story. Congress is going to protect us, right?
I'm going to wash my hands.
Sorry to be dark.
No. It's
when you
good
say 200 years, I kind of think.
Nice day. This has been fascinating. We have a lot of great questions. I'm going to invite all of you, as you hear your question, to feel free to stand up and lip sync and act, and then the cameras will catch you. But let's go through them as quickly as we can. There are quite a number here. So one question on the floor is, do you foresee federal data security and privacy legislation passing in the near future? And if it does, do you think it will hinder or enable innovation? Scott?
I think there's a lot of concern around the NSA kind of stuff, if that's what the question is about. And that's been... it's being whittled down. I don't think that you'll see anything too dramatic. I think it'll be incremental.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Federal law or just other laws around data security and privacy are going to have some impact. I mean, certainly there are a number of countries that have seized upon these disclosures from Snowden and are really pushing hard on cross-border data flows and these kinds of issues. And you know, are you going to have to put all your servers in every country and keep the data there? And, you know, sort of this notion of the balkanization of the internet. And that will hurt. That will definitely hurt innovation.
You know, I'd say in the terms of the medical realm, there's some real innovation that's possible. The future of medicine will be comparing my genome and your genome and drawing inferences. The trouble is that without knowing anything about me, and there's been great studies on this, you could identify me to the person based on some chromosomal data. And so, you know, as much as we want to do with current standards of privacy, just by looking at a person's genome, you can identify who they are. So probably has to be some great innovation around comparative genomics and so how you handle that type of genomic security. But I think private industry will figure that one out. There's a big idea there, or several.
Relation to bootstrapping, is there investment in local elementary or middle schools in this arena, for example, 3D printers in school science labs? Paul?
Well, I mean, that stuff is happening. One of the actually things that we like a lot is this FIRST Robotics competition that Dean Kamen started. I'm on the board of that now. Qualcomm just sponsored the finals, which were recently in St. Louis. And there's a whole sequence of them. It starts out with Legos and it moves to, you know, kids building robots that are kind of this big. And that's another thing that goes to this issue of motivation, because kids actually see that they can build stuff that works and does some task, and they compete, and you know it's turned into kind of a sporting event. So cheerleaders are there, and everybody, you know, it's one of these things that sort of captures a lot of the things that motivate kids to do things, is social aspects and getting the recognition for it. So I think that's, you know, that kind of thing where it's not just giving them the tools, but it's giving them the motivation to use those tools to create something that's really cool, and they get recognition for it and satisfaction out of it. I think that's really important, and we've been doing a lot in those areas. But we're doing stuff in other areas as well, but that one stands out to me as a great one, great example.
I don't know if this is something our panel can do, but I can comment on it if you guys don't. But what roles might technology and innovation play in world agriculture and water security?
Fun fact is 98% of all crops in the United States for food source are genetically modified. And so as much as we see in the media today this outpouring of people concerned about GMO, the reality is our food sources have already been genetically modified to create an overabundance of food, certainly in this country and most of the developed world. So, you know, I'm very bullish, though, that to feed the world, which we still have not done, that genetic modification of some of these basic crops around corn and soy are the way to allow what is today almost unfertile land to become fertile, to where you can engineer a corn not to require all the water that it currently does. or to not need as much sunlight as it currently does. And so it would be, for me, just so refreshing to see a more educated conversation around GMO of its incredible humanitarian benefits for the rest of the world that's still not fully getting the food sources it needs. The U.S. leads in this area. We are by far the world leader in agricultural science. And yet, I think today it's under assault. And again, it's another area of innovation where we stand the risk of really losing an incredible advantage.
I just mentioned just to this person later, I just attended a conference in Qatar, Doha, Qatar, around this subject. And there's a man named Fahad Alatia, who's the head of their food, their national security and water security. It's exactly in this space, who's worked with the RAND Corporation and kind of created a league of countries that are in arid regions. So, if you're, and I used to represent Jeff Bingaman or work for Jeff Bingaman, the senator of New Mexico. And so a lot of the New Mexico water issues or Mexico water issues are part of this. And so it's a huge issue in which there's a lot more innovation going on around information technology and the applied use of that, which is quite interesting. So I'm happy to connect folks with that if you would like later. Let's see here. Immigration, tax policy, patent, these are all national policies. Are there things local governments can do to create the right policy environment for innovation? Great question. You've been on both sides of this.
Well, I think what I've tried to get San Diego to realize is we're in a competition for talent against other places. So this has to be a great place to live. And I'll just tell you a story I haven't told you, Paul, maybe you heard it indirectly, but someone came into my office. They were the real estate people, and they said, Qualcomm's thinking of not expanding because there's too much traffic.
That came from me.
I said, what? I said, I heard it sort of secondhand, so I called a meeting here in this building with local people to talk about what we could do about that. Maybe there's some things we could do about on that. But I think that the main thing, I think, is that most people haven't been in technology who go into government, and that's probably fine. That's what we should expect. You have to you really have to listen hard for what a company needs or what you need to support a good talent pool. So we need we need good parks. We need nice. It's great to have great weather. It's great to have clean beaches, but we also need a good transportation system. Good housing options. I think the rise of downtown has been good for San Diego because it creates a number of options for lifestyle and for growth. But just making a healthy city is good for technology, I think.
Follow up on the traffic issue? So you think about something as simple as that.
Traffic policy?
Yeah. And it causes our employees to leave earlier in the day. So I'm having a clear productivity loss, and it comes from things as simple as a light, getting onto the freeway here, backing the traffic up so much that you can spend 45 minutes going down a road that normally would take you 30 seconds. And just that simple of a thing has caused a lot of our employees to leave a few hours earlier. And I said, look, if I can't fix that problem, then now there's a huge disadvantage to continuing the concentration of people in Sorrento Mesa area. Anyway, so we will not be building more buildings here if we can't solve the traffic problem. And if we don't build them here, you say, well, why don't we put a campus somewhere else in San Diego? That may happen, but then you run into the tax issue. So a lot of the people who are coming here say, well, could you put me in Austin? I know you got something there, because then I don't have to pay as high of state tax. So all these things sort of interrelate to each other. But it started, like you said, it started from this traffic problem, and I realized that we were having employees, working much, much less.
That's a great example. But let me ask out one other question. Let me just take it back to the other side, where the question was on the national side. And I don't want to get you in trouble with any groups, but I remember when I worked for Jeff Bingaman, I was tasked by him of trying to create a compromise in a piece of legislation called the TEAM Act, trying to allow companies like Qualcomm or others that were organized very differently than they were in the 1930s and 40s to allow teams to work, and so that the difference between managers and workers was becoming much blurrier, and you had inputs coming in from a variety of areas. That may all sound logical and a normal thing today. It was as if we had, in the Democratic Party at that point, created the biggest fissure, the biggest intern inside the Beltway earthquake that you could imagine. John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO at that time, visited my boss five times complaining about me. And Jeff Bingaman has said he's doing what I've asked him to do, which is we have a lot of high-tech employers in New Mexico who say we can't operate under the kind of old rules by which companies were organized. And I'm interested from your perspective, do you still run into anachronistic laws of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s that are just incumbent, stupid laws that haven't been updated and need to be updated that inhibit innovation? That's where the national equation does matter?
Well, I always used to say in San Diego, there's two attitudes about change. There's one group of people who's very, very skeptical of change, and the other people are absolutely opposed. The problem is that no one trusts what they don't know, and so that's just always sort of an institutional problem. I think the ironic kind of fortunate thing is that in a lot of ways the government hasn't caught up with technology enough to regulate it yet. So in the technology space, you don't see the kind of specific laws over pieces of property or things that you see in other sectors. But really, what I think the consensus of folks that I talk to who are in the technology industries is we have to set national policies that allow the interactions and innovations to happen. So good tax policy. In fact, I would just recommend the Rifkin. Professor Porter and Professor Ripken at the Harvard Business School did this competitiveness project. They talk about the eight things we have to do to restore American competitiveness. You should all look at it. Tom Rice is a Republican from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we are running around the freshman class trying to get people interested in this. It's scary for people to think of things in a new way.
Instead of or in addition to hiring talented immigrants, why not invest more in upgrading the skills of new grads and existing U.S. employees? In other words, the question is why not just focus on the talent here? There's large unemployment here. You've got groups like IEEE that are basically saying we've got the engineering bandwidth to fill these jobs. So what does inhibit that as opposed to doing the others? Paul?
I don't think it is inhibited. I mean, we do that. It's just that you want to get the best and the brightest to come and stay here. So wherever in the world they came from, you want them to be here. And that's really the issue. But I just have a stat here in terms of, because that there's such a red herring around all of this stuff. Oh, that taking away jobs from America. This is not true. It's actually the opposite. The people that come generally create opportunity for us. So the stat just came out National Bureau for Economic Research working paper shows that an increase of 1 percentage point in the number of foreign STEM workers increases wages of local native workers by up to 8% for college graduates and 3 to 4% for non-college graduates. So it's just not right. I mean, those arguments are false arguments.
I love this question on the assault on science. How do we technology leaders convince people to support legislation that is actually in their self-interest? And I know that's broad, but we do this. This may be more rumor than real, and so I may be, committing journalistic heresy because I haven't checked it out. But I tweeted out yesterday that I was going to be having this conversation with all of you, I got a lot of emails saying that we're at least three GOP chairs or sub-chairs of committees related to science, where these three individuals were creationists, and
my committee.
Yeah, that's your committee. So that is true.
So I'm on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. Sometimes we call it the Science Committee. Use air quotes. Whenever someone comes in to talk about the effect of human activity on climate, it could be the Secretary of Energy, it could be the School of the Environment chair from a major university. They'll get a lecture, and I've heard one of my colleague. Address the Secretary of Energy, who had discussed climate change, and he said, "Well, we're talking about Hurricane Sandy, which was a $60 billion off-budget expenditure right at the beginning of my term." And he says, "I'm from Long Beach State, and you're from MIT, but this is how I see it." He says, "In 1910, there was as big a storm as Hurricane Sandy, so I don't see what the difference is." That's kind of, we get a lot more of that than you'd be surprised. In fact, it's a little bit frightening. It's a lot frightening for some of the Republicans who've left Congress to look back at the Science Committee, which also used to be the most bipartisan committee. Right now, the Armed Services Committee is the most bipartisan committee because it's fairly easy to understand what the mission is. But when you, you know, don't even agree on what the scientific facts are, you don't even agree that there are risks out there, even if we don't understand them 100%, that we have to address. That's a frightening thing. And I'm asking for the input of all you to say, if all those people hear from, frankly, is Fox News.
Is there a communications and marketing? I mean, it occurs to me as we sit in San Diego, I had the privilege of meeting a few times Roger Revelle. And it's Revelle's work on carbon and whatnot that Al Gore and others popularized. But I mean, it was absolutely vital science at the same time when Irwin Jacobs and others were creating. So those people that live and operate with cell phones and are highly connected and whatnot are taking in one bit of science that came out of San Diego while at the same time rejecting another piece of science. So it's a selective acquiescence, if you will, a selective use of science.
There's another dangerous thing going on, too, that you should watch. One of the great, Greg will appreciate that peer review has been one of the things that's been great for science, is that the idea is that people would take these basic scientific research, come up with these ideas, other scientists would look at it, beat the heck out of the papers and make sure that they were covered. And that whole system is under assault now in the science committee as well. And in fact, there's an effort by my chairman, who's a tremendously nice guy, but I think misguided on this, to sort of direct from the Congress what people would research. And that's, yeah, so I'm just saying that
He's a really nice guy.
But you know, I just think, and if you met him, you'd say, wow, he's a tremendous guy. But this
Jesse
is
Helms was a nice guy.
This is a really, it's a really frightening kind of, we have such a great system that we've built that we are not investing in, and that we would, you know, the idea that we would try to undercut it or erode it ought to be alarming to people, just like letting the bridges fall down. We would never let the bridges fall down. We would say that was a stupid thing to do. Not investing in science is just as dumb.
Good question here. How can we integrate the engineering, innovation, and clinical research of Tijuana into San Diego innovation?
We're actually doing something quite interesting in Tijuana with it's actually a project, one of our wireless reach projects. You probably can answer the question better, but where there is a clinic, so it's not clinical trial, but they're supporting a very large number of diabetic patients at the border from a very small clinic. And we actually set up a program by which people can go out into the community, lightly skilled healthcare workers, go out in the community with cell phones and actually provide care to diabetic patients and create a huge amount of scaling of of the healthcare for those people. And so there are interesting opportunities. You know, as I said earlier, the regulatory burden in the United States might cause it to be that mobile health starts in other places first. Having Tijuana close by and having the ability to have that relationship with that clinic down there to get that wireless reach project going, and our ability to sort of stay on top of it and interact, I think, is good. But maybe you want to talk about clinical trials.
Well, I think the topic of can we do more with our brothers and sisters in Mexico is a great topic for San Diego. I'm on the board of Care Fusion, one of the big medical devices here in town, and they have an incredibly large complex in Tijuana for manufacturing, and it's a way to alleviate the pressures of some of the taxes and the regulatory burden of California and yet stay in the region. You know, taking the question, though, a little broader of how do you connect patients to the technology, to the trials, I think San Diego has a unique advantage actually with Tijuana to do that, and we're not doing enough of it. So you've got these great research institutes. They're all very independent of one another still, and very, for the most part, independent of the hospital systems here in town. And one of my missions as chairman of Sanford Burnham is to hopefully lead that community more together about how we get this translational research happening far faster in San Diego than anywhere else. I think Boston's done a very good job because of the power of Harvard and MIT in that equation, but we can do something more here in San Diego, and that's a really big opportunity for us in this region.
Good question. New York Times reported that the repatriated profits from the last tax holiday were not invested in R&D. Can we structure the next holiday differently to encourage this?
That is not true in the case of Qualcomm. We added jobs. We actually invested in a new technology built out of a whole system that was our mobile TV system. Some of the funding came from that. So, you know, it's people like to say that the money wasn't put to good use. I actually even argue with the premise of it, because some of the people say, well, it wasn't good use if you returned it to shareholders. Why is that not good use? Then people don't want to talk about multiplier effect. You know, when that money then comes into the economy and now it gets spent and it creates a lot of economic benefit. So, that story is wrong on all sorts of levels.
That is the biggest red herring. I mean, I just think, what is the benefit? What are you getting out of keeping it offshore? What is the benefit of that? So you bring it back, and people may invest it here, or they may pay taxes on it as a dividend. But what is the benefit of trapping it overseas? It's only going to be used overseas. It's the dumbest thing. It's in a range of dumb things you come across.
And it is primarily in your party that there's been big resistance in the Democratic Party.
And they
party.
Say this thing, well, I'll tell you, my party, I have a trouble with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on campaign finance reform, because they treat corporations as a person. We all say, oh, corporations aren't people. Well, then you talk to them about repatriation, and they talk about it like a person. Well, that corporation should invest it here, even. I mean, it should. Should is something you say to a person, right? But corporations aren't people. They're not voters. They're not people. They're not patriots. They're going to do what's in their economic best interest. And what we want is we want that money to come home, to have the opportunity to be invested here. We have to do other things to make this a good place to invest. As Paul told me when he told me the story the first time, he says there's other issues with investing in California. I'd love to work with my state colleagues to make it easier here. But gosh, if you can't get the money back in the first instance, and they're not going to take a 35% haircut, it would be the wrong thing for them to do as a corporation.
I mean, what's been unfortunate in this debate, editorialize for a moment, is the timing. You had John Chambers and a lot of other people, John of Cisco, pushing on this, but you had the 2008-2009 financial crisis where demand in this country collapsed. And the collapse of demand led to a lot of joblessness, a lot of lack of investment. You had corporate but the problem is there's got to be a demand equation in terms of some of this investment. So the view was that corporations are getting a freebie without being required to invest to solve this problem that people see in demand. And I think there's a lot of mistaken logic points in that. But to add to that, there are pieces of legislation in Congress like John Delaney, who's been trying to direct a portion of those repatriate issues into infrastructure banks, looking at payroll tax issues, which are a bigger thing of giving firms a benefit for hiring more folks. I tend to agree where Paul is, that the story of development in Japan, in Korea, on which you chair the U.S. Korea Business Council, I tell people these are nations that grew with a high degree, let's just be honest, a high degree of institutionalized corruption in Japan and Korea. But why did they largely succeed? They largely succeeded at the time in part because there were very high walls to capital flight. So as much as you were able to kind of trap capital in a country, it had beneficial effects, corrupt or not. And rather than being stuffed in the Cayman Islands or something. So it's an interesting thing that we wouldn't look at those lessons and say the more capital you have actually coming in, it gives you the wherewithal to do more. But those are some of the dimensions of this. But Paul?
Steve, just one other thing. You were talking before about manufacturing. And obviously, I think Paul made a good point. We're not going to start sewing dresses here in the United States again, right? But what we
some
could
people
do,
are.
Yeah. What we could do, though, because what we haven't talked about is the incredible revolution in energy in this country, is we now have an energy advantage, and if we could bring the capital back the right way, we would have a capital advantage, and the U.S. has the rule of law. Every sophisticated manufacturing plant on the world would at least have the United States as a first choice going forward. And so instead of these manufacturing centers of excellence in Cincinnati or wherever, which is a little bit of window dressing, fix those fundamental, just one or two issues, and you're going to have massive investment in big, sophisticated manufacturing.
And that's, by the way, exactly what the Harvard folks say out of the competitiveness project.
So just to make this very concrete, so the money that we're talking about is money that was earned because we are selling to companies that are offshore right now. It is not taxed by the United States because there's this thing that says if you are going to indefinitely invest it offshore, then you won't tax it. So it's kind of like territorial, meaning that we pay on earnings that we made in the United States, companies do, and we don't pay on earnings that were made offshore. But the catch is the way that it's set up is that if you want to spend that money that's offshore in the United States, then you pay the taxes on it. If we went to a territorial system, it would say, that money that's offshore, you still won't pay taxes on it. But by the way, you can bring it back to the United States and invest in the United States. So it's the same thing, except you've just removed this one bit which says you can't spend it in the United States. That's why it's so idiotic. You already have the effect of territorial in the sense that that money is staying offshore. You already have the fact that the United States is not taxing that money, even though we say that we have a worldwide taxation system. The only time it gets taxed is when it is used in the United States to create jobs, to invest, to do... That's why we're so incredulous. By the way,
you are paying tax in China, Switzerland, wherever you made the money.
Right, you are paying taxes. It's not that you're not paying taxes. You are paying taxes where... That's what I actually really want to see that happen. I want to see manufacturing come. I think Mexico is really sitting in a wonderful position to be one of the main manufacturing centers of the world. And from a geopolitical standpoint, creating some balance there would be very, very beneficial to the United States.
Thank you, Malin. I've been given the notes that we need to bring. I'd love to spend another hour. There are the fantastic questions here, and we've gone through a big chunk of them. But let me just ask this final one. It says, San Diego companies get to a certain size and then get bought. And there are a great number of examples here. The Bay Area has 50 tech companies that are billion-dollar companies. San Diego has two. How do we get more?
Well, that's a question for Greg. But... let me just say one thing as he thinks about how to be diplomatic. The one thing I've noticed here is that I worried a lot about that thing, but it turns out that having talent here is really very important. To me, it's the more important thing just by observing it. I visited BP's biofuels, and this is a story that's just representative of a lot of things I hear. British Petroleum's biofuels thing is in my district. Every bit of the rest of their operation is in Chicago and mostly in Houston. And, you know, so as we go through this tour, I said, why is it that this facility is here? And then maybe a couple hundred employees. They said, we just couldn't get people to move. They said, this is where the science is. This is where the people are. This is where they want to stay. And so for us, this is the right place to be. And again, I think from the local level, from the state level, and the federal level, we have to recognize that we're in a competition for talent, and that ought to be our focus. And whether it's immigration policy, education policy, particularly those two, but in any way, we ought to be making sure that our focus is bringing talent to San Diego, making this a place where they want to stay, and making this a place where the businesses can succeed and families can grow up.
Thank you. Greg?
So shareholders, I think, have to do what's in their economic best interests. And in our case, it was a compelling idea and offer to bring our company together with Thermo Fisher Scientific. I would build on Scott's point, though, which is that ultimately what determines the success of a region like San Diego is the ability to have the attraction of capital, the ability to have a really good regulatory government support system that wants that capital to be attracted, and then a place where the smart people stick around and go on to form the next company and the next company. And that's more important than creating a billion-dollar company and asking it never to be sold. What you really want to do is create the circumstances that 10 more billion-dollar companies are getting formed each and every day.
I think that's a great answer. Final thoughts, Paul?
On that issue, or
why don't you go back to immigration or 3D printing?
3D printing? I think San Diego's in a really interesting position right now because we are doing some fundamental work, fundamental science. And if I look at what's going on in Silicon Valley right now, there's a lot of focus on like apps and things that are not particularly deep. And it's actually created a huge opportunity for Qualcomm because we know that the venture capitalists up there are not funding the things that we're funding. So there's almost open field for us to invest in these various areas. But in regard to creating other companies, the thing I said earlier about life sciences and telecom being such centers of excellence in San Diego, I can see a lot of companies growing up there, and there are some that are doing that right now. And so we just got to keep nurturing those companies, and Qualcomm will do our part to try and be a great partner and, you know, help with our money, help with our resources. We don't really like it when too many of our employees leave to do those startups, but, you know, that will happen too. I think San Diego is sitting in a very, very good place for what the, you know, where the next mega trends are going. So it should happen.
I just want to thank all of you. I think I didn't know where this was going to go this morning, but I think we had a real conversation. I learned a lot of important issues were discussed. I think your comment about deep science or thinking about real serious investments that have potential systemic effects are so important and vital, and that's such a big part of the San Diego story, UC San Diego, what's built off of that. For the gentleman who talked about needing a lot more billion-dollar companies that stay here where decisions are here, I sort of think the notion of having, you know, the best talent churn in the country that sort of continues to kind of create stuff in a way plays a much larger, you know, national and international public good in some of this. And I'm glad to see, Scott, you're sort of wandering through this. And I'll say finally, because it's not nice, you know, I'm not trying to be nice to Qualcomm. You know, in my view, one of the things you get to look at a lot is at the philanthropy that companies make. And that sometimes, you know, I've been intrigued with and disturbed at the same time by the fact that Qualcomm has these competitions out for folks to look at how can various sorts of communications technology be applied to various problems. So you can see, I used to tell people in development around the world, if you really want to think about development in Africa, you need to show me how you're going to move the needle for a single head of household woman farmer growing cotton in Congo. And until you could change that, and now you can see financial inclusion through cell phones. You can see health services and health monitoring and whatnot through cell phones, which is one of the Qualcomm projects. A lot of that, maybe I'm ignorant about it, is not happening in the United States to the same degree that you see some of this abroad. I've been really intrigued with the application of some of these things here. So I look at, there are some policy inhibitors. But when you look at what's coming, I look at a very exciting role, and San Diego has its DNA in so much of what the rest of the world is wearing and applying to itself and trying to organize itself around. So when I think this has been a wonderful conversation on innovation. There's been so much here, but it's been a pleasure to sort of talk about what's needed now for the next wave that's coming. So please thank Scott Peters, Paul Jacobs, and Greg Lucier. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.